Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome back to Candidate Confessional, the podcast that everybody, and by everybody I mean my immediate family, is listening to. I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And Jason, on this episode, I want to ask a question. How do you leave the thing that you love? How do you retire gracefully?
Are you trying to tell me something, Sam?
No. I'm talking about people like Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, Brett Favre. You know, athletes that played well past their prime and had trouble leaving the stage.
It's easy to see why, because work can become an obsession and it can really form who we are as people, our identities.
Exactly.
And who wants to retire to early bird specials in the corporate lecture circuit?
Well, those early bird specials aren't so bad, but that brings us to this week's episode.
Stuffed French toast. It's delicious.
Back to this week's episode. We talked to a Washington legend who came out of retirement to run for president in 2012. One, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
His heyday was 20 years ago in 94.
Exactly. He led the Republican takeover of the House of Representatives after 40 years in the wilderness.
And at the time, he came to define conservatism. I mean, he had the contract with America.
Exactly. And he also did budget battles with Bill Clinton. He led the impeachment hearings with Monica Lewinsky. And then it all went away. He was the victim of an insurrection in his own party. He had his own ethical issues. And he spent his retirement kind of as this, like, talking head figure. He authored a number of books, probably all of which are on your conservative uncle's bookshelf.
Or the remainder table at your bargain bookstore.
One or the other. Now, through his time of office, there was always these murmurings that he would run for president. And in 2012, he finally made the plunge. And it was just as incredible as everyone predicted. Gingrich, this outsized personality forced into a world where everything is sort of meticulously scripted. A political virtuoso who was often his own worst enemy.
He proved how hard it is to come out of retirement and run for president. And in short, it was equal parts train wreck and a work of art.
Beyond the bluster.
Behind the bunting.
Past the posters.
After the ads.
The campaign picks up.
And the motorcade moves on.
What happens when the votes are counted?
And democracy doesn't go your way.
This is Candidate Confessional, a HuffPost podcast.
I'm Sam Stein. Okay. I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And we approve this podcast. I think it's fair to charitably say that your campaign didn't start off the way you wanted it to start off. There was a few bumps in the road early on.
I think it's fair to say that we took a huge detour, ran into a brick wall, and fell into a swamp.
And specifically, there was the criticism of the Paul Ryan Medicare plan. Yeah. There was the Tiffany's issue, the expense account. And I'm wondering, as this was happening, did you feel like you were rusty politically? You hadn't run for election in a little while.
No, I was surprised at the difference in intensity level because having been Speaker of the House in a pretty intense period, I was used to that part of it. There were two different components, though. I mean, one was the internal problems in that we really wanted to run something close to what Sanders is running now. We wanted to run an internet-based, idea-oriented, you know, totally new model campaign. And we brought in to think about it a group of people who were old model professionals who were very good at what they do. It just wasn't what I wanted to do. And so we spent at least 5 months just colliding and not getting anything done. And that would, so internally we had that problem. Externally you talked about two totally different things, which partly were probably – one of them at least was a failure on my part to understand context, because it should have been fairly easy to turn to to Bob and say to him, you know, I love my wife and I like being able to get her something nice and I work really hard. What's the beef?
Yeah.
And it just didn't, you know, I was operating a level below that.
Who's Bob here?
Bob Schieffer.
Okay.
Because he's the one who kept saying, gee, I can't understand this. And I should have just turned and said, look, you know, I have a very good income and I like my wife a whole lot and I want to buy her something nice. What's your problem?
Did the question surprise you?
It did. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was one of those things where you thought, how could this be, you know.
They're talking about like Tiffany's.
I mean, you're running against Mitt Romney.
He's the one with the car elevator.
Romney doesn't have a line of credit because he just buys with cash. And then the thing I said about Ryan, if you'll notice, where I was surprised there was how much Ryan had become iconic on the right, and therefore to touch him was to get into a big brawl.
Yeah.
The fact was I was right, and if you look at the bill he introduced with Wyden 3 or 4 months later, it took into account all of my objections. And he called me and said, I'm now introducing this bill. Can you say something nice about it?
You were like, well, do you remember what happened during the campaign? Maybe I want to
Maybe you
want to
say
again.
Something nice about me.
Oh, no. Yeah, it was fine.
It seems like the reason I ask about the rust is because the campaign became about these sort of moments, right? Like you would touch something, it would blow up. You would have something else happen, it would become a moment. One of those was you got glitter bombed. I mean, by glitter bomb, I want to just lay it out. You were doing a book signing, and someone came and just dumped a box of glitter on you, advocating gay marriage. That must have been really insane to have happened to you. What was it like?
Now, look, I've spent my whole career in public life, and I used to do town hall meetings when Sacha Baron Cohen used to do this BBC show. We actually did the show.
Wagwan, Evertinari. I is here with my main man, his name be Newt Gingrich, and him was the leader of the House of Representatives.
So, you know, Ali G comes in, and it was obvious in about two sentences that this is, you know, and Tyler wants to stop it, and I said, no, it's fine. If you ever get a chance to watch it, it's on YouTube, and you know, it's had several million views, and, you know, and I was totally relaxed. Well, one of my former district director said to me, she knew exactly what I did. I went into the mode I used when I did town hall meetings, and somebody who was nutty would show up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a whole, you know, you develop a rhythm and a style. So getting glitter bombed is part of a free society.
What is the mode you enter when that happens? What's the internal mindset?
The internal mindset is you create a gap between you and the other person psychically, and you allow them to live out what they need.
Okay.
And you wait for the audience to get tired of them, and then the audience shuts them down.
Okay.
But you never shut them down.
Yeah, you don't challenge the glitter bomber.
Yeah.
He does
you
thing.
Don't throw the glitter back at the glitter
bomber. Yeah, no, that would be terrible.
You just relax, and you realize everybody else around you thinks this person's an idiot.
That's something that you constantly or consistently throughout the campaign brought up, your sort of surprise or displeasure at the media for trivializing every little moment into this big thing. And I'm wondering if that was something, too, that you were surprised at, something that had changed over time since you had campaigned last, sort of hit-driven.
I think the cycle had gotten faster and the coverage may have gotten somewhat dumber. I mean, I describe, for example, Trump as the natural candidate for the Kardashian era.
Yeah.
Because we've gotten into this, and I tweet a lot. I mean, we have 1,600,000 followers.
You're prolific.
But it's so, you know, it comes and it goes. I mean, you know, the best of all tweets are instantaneous and disappear.
Yeah.
And that's a, you know, or you, you know, you do Instagram or you do whatever you do.
Well, place your trip to the Greek islands in that context. You went there to recharge the batteries, basically.
Okay, but I also did it as a deliberate act of defiance.
Really?
Sure.
How so? Why?
Well, partially for my own professional consultants and partially for the whole nature of campaigning. You know, I wanted time to actually think. Many years ago, we had this reporter at the Washington Post who came up to me one day and he was complaining. It was like February or March, and he said, I came back to cover the Conservative Opportunity Society, and you guys have done nothing for the last 2 months. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I'm really disappointed. And I said, well, you know, we've been planning. He said, planning? That doesn't count. So part of my view was, what if you were healthy and you decided you would go take 10 days off? And you would go look at the Greek crisis. You'd go and look at Turkey. You'd come back home with a deeper perspective. You know, now, if I had organized a 10-country trip where I rushed into a press event, rushed out, people have said, oh, Gingrich is being appropriately presidential.
Fact-finding mission.
Fact-finding mission.
Yes.
But I'm happy to cheerfully say to people, look, you know, I give fairly substantive talks because I actually learn substance.
Was the act of defiance, was the act of defiance, as you call it, that you knew it would not play well domestically?
It was my way of saying to the professional consultants who had spent 3 months trying to tell me I had to become their candidate. That I actually had in the back of my head a rhythm and a pattern, and I was going to run my campaign. And if they would like to be part of my campaign, that'd be terrific. But I had no interest in being part of their campaign.
What was the comp? What did they tell you? What do they want you to do?
They wanted me to be quiet, raise a lot of money, and let them run ads. And they had no understanding of the scale of the internet we wanted to use. And some of these, by the way, are very smart people. They're not stupid people. But for example, their idea of using the internet was a very directed model, where it was aimed, you know, let's find out who the NRA members are and we'll send them a gun message. Mm-hmm. My idea of using the internet was to figure out ways to cause noise and to have interesting ideas and to try to get people engaged. And we still do this. I mean, we do, for example, Facebook Q&As mm-hmm. that regularly get thousands of viewers.
Do they also want a say in your message and how you presented yourself and the kind of
to some extent. But part of the difference was, And we didn't pull it off because in the end they may have been right strategically in the sense that if I'd understood fully what I was up against with Romney, the correct answer was to not run, because there was no possibility, unless I could create an insurgency, and this is where Trump and Sanders are interesting, unless I could create an insurgency, there was no possibility of competing inside the regular party against Romney. And that's why I kept trying to say to them. I mean, me going around to see millionaires who know Mitt Romney, invested with Mitt Romney, like the way he sounds like a business leader, and trying to raise money against him is crazy. It won't happen.
Did you try that? And they said, hey.
Well, I talked to a bunch of very close personal friends who just said, you know, I really love you, but after all, I'm for Mitt.
So you need to be the outsider candidate.
Right.
Yeah. When you got back from Greece, that's when, pardon my French, shit really hit the fan, it felt like.
Actually, the last day we were in Greece, they basically called and said, you know, we need to have a meeting, and either you need to become our candidate or all of us are leaving.
Well, they ruined your time in Greece.
No, it was perfect timing because we were refreshed, we were renewed, and on the way to the airport, Calista and I discussed it, and she said, you know, and to her credit, she said, look, we're staying in the race. They can do what they need to.
So what was the meeting like?
We met briefly, and I said, I understand that you're not comfortable with me as a candidate, and there's no possibility of my becoming the candidate you want. So I appreciate it. It's fine. And all of them left. And then we called a meeting 2 hours later of our original team who had been with me for years. And they all said, well, we're glad that's over with, because those people – they said to me at that point, those people all said to us, don't do any of the things we do. And within 48 hours, we were moving at a rhythm totally. If we'd had that rhythm for the preceding 5 months, we probably still couldn't have beaten Mitt. But it would have been a much more fun race.
You described yourself in that moment as Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense. You were the only one who didn't know you were dead at that moment.
That was their view.
That was their view, not your view. Okay.
No.
Did you never thought about leaving the campaign ever?
Yeah, we were in a car on the way to the airport in Istanbul, and I said, okay, this is what they're going to do.
Yeah.
What do you think? And Calista said, well, I think they leave and we stay.
And that was that.
She said, we're not getting out of this race.
Did you have doubts, though?
No, not at that. No, but part of that's because I'm a high wire artist. I mean, you know,
that's such a good term.
Well, I mean, if you run for Congress in the middle of Watergate in Georgia as a Republican, then you arrive in Congress, and before you're even sworn in, you say, why don't we have a plan to become a majority? And you spend 16 years doing that. Then you take the incumbent president of the United States head-to-head and say, we're going to balance the budget whether you like it or not. You know, there aren't many things that worry me. I mean, my dad retired after 27 years in the infantry as a lieutenant colonel. So my attitude is, every cool thing I've ever done has been sort of a gift. And why complain?
Well, that's funny. It's a really good point, which is you were uncomfortable with the conventional path. And people, you know, your reputation is that you like the drama. You want to roll the dice sometimes.
Sure.
And I think the insurgency campaign fit you in that respect.
Right. Okay. Look, I'm Scots and Irish. I mean, my father's name is Robert Bruce. My grandson's name is Robert Bruce. I mean, you know, Robert the Bruce ends up, you know, in a cave watching a spider weave and fight. It takes him 17 years to win independence. It took me 16 years to create a majority.
So you're the modern-day Robert the Bruce.
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I'm very comfortable being an insurgent. I'm very comfortable saying we need change.
Then how do you set about running
an
insurgent?
By the way, I'm very uncomfortable being bored.
Comeback starts, right? You're at
the
bottom, and you start coming. When did you know it was kind of clicking a little bit? Was there one moment?
Did you ever feel like it was clicking?
Well, part of it is, this may sound goofy, I'm really a happy warrior.
Yeah.
I tell people, the best way to understand me is I'm a four-year-old who gets up every morning knowing that there are cookies. I don't know where the cookies
what
are.
What kind of cookies?
They may be in the refrigerator. This is pre-computer.
Okay.
They may be in the refrigerator. They may be on the stove. They may be in the kitchen or whatever. But I know there are cookies. So I spend all day happily chasing cookies. I mean, this is my natural life. So and I like campaigning. I like people.
Yeah.
I love Iowa. Calista went to Luther. We had lots of friends in Iowa, and we were having a ball. And in fact, it was very weird. Because the week that I got in this whole fight over Ryan, the crowds in Iowa were terrific.
Yeah.
And we were doing very, very well. We had big turnouts, but we were getting our brains beaten out in the national media. And for two full days, there was this dissonance in my own head between what I was experiencing out there and what was happening.
But was there ever a point as you got closer to the caucus and then the primary that you were like, you know, I'm making up some ground? Or was it just that the other people in the race kept – you know, tripping up.
Screwing up.
Oh, no, I think we're gaining ground. And okay. I think this is one of the ironic things watching the current debates. I mean, the debates were clearly the key to my survival.
Exactly.
And it was also the key to some people not surviving. I mean,
Rick
Pawlenty's
Perry.
Inability. The two great examples are Pawlenty being given a chance by John King to face down Romney and freezing. And then Rick not being able to remember whatever the third department was. Which in his case was, I think, entirely a function of Percocet and having had back surgery. They should not have gotten him in the race. And Rick and I had talked earlier in the year, and I'd said, you know, if you want to run, I won't. And he said, no, I don't want to run. I want you to run. So, I mean, so his endorsing me in South Carolina was sort of coming full circle. And some of the guys who were with me left me to go talk Rick into running, which was really a disservice. Perry's a much, much better person than that episode implied. So those two are good examples. The other part was, and I don't quite know how to explain it, Romney has an enormous ability to organize, and he has had a huge financial network, which he had earned. I mean, his father's experience, his own experience. I could never compete in that world. But I had really spent a long time learning how to be effective in a speech or debate setting. So that was my world. You know, I mean, he had his world over here, I had my world over here. And I was very comfortable the longer we went on. That we were doing, you know, that we were getting better and better at that. And I think with a few breaks, we might have done even better than we did.
Well, let's talk about one of those settings. I mean, the most glorious for you, I would say, would probably be the one with John King.
Nope. The most glorious occurred earlier at Myrtle Beach.
That was with Juan Williams.
It was a defensive work.
All right.
Tell the story.
Well, I mean, what was astonishing, I can't remember how Juan phrased it, but Juan basically created a classic liberal position that, you know, you can't really expect people to do work. You know, it's the old "how can you work at McDonald's" routine. And I gave a very strong defense of the work ethic and the importance of work. And it was weird because the Myrtle Beach was probably the largest debate in numbers, and so you had like 3,000 people in this auditorium. And all of a sudden, starting at the very back, you begin getting this standing ovation. And if you see it on TV, it comes down. Like it's a wave.
And learn someday to own the job. Okay. When we come back.
You get overwhelmed. You have the sense of, one, you know you're resonating. You know, and by the way, it explains the kind.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Verse explains some of Trump's anger of these last two debates, because getting booed is really unpopular. I mean, you don't like... You, it's much nicer to have a standing ovation.
Could it also be bewildering in a way, because the moment leaves you, you're excited that you got cheers, but there's always going to be another question or somebody else.
No, that's irrelevant.
It doesn't matter.
Look, my theory of debating is you want to hit one or two home runs a night. You don't want to try to hit 16. So if I know, and the first one, candidly, was the very first debate, which I think was at Ames. Because I hit Chris Wallace. And it was a perfect setup, because Brett Baer had said, now we don't want any of these gotcha things and we're going to be serious. And then Wallace promptly asked a gotcha question. So I read back what Baer had said. Mm-hmm. Well, the next morning we're in O'Hare changing planes, and this airline pilot comes up to me and says, I am so glad you did that last night.
Did that?
And I began to realize that there's this whole market that, and this again is the Trump environment, there's this whole market on the right that says, I am so sick of these people, you know, and I'm so glad you stood up to them.
But, okay, I have to then ask, because the John King one, which wasn't as good as the one William won in your estimation.
It wasn't as satisfying, but it was actually unbelievable.
It was unbelievable.
I mean, the audience went crazy.
I need to set it up for the listener. Essentially what had happened was an ABC News story to come out about your first marriage.
Right.
Okay. And he raised the story and the circumstances around your second marriage and when he left your wife at the very beginning of the debate.
The very first question.
And you teed off.
People to run for public office, and I am appalled that you would begin a presidential debate on a topic like that.
In 1995, the morning that I was going to become the first Republican speaker in 40 years, CBS broke the story that my mother had told Connie Chung that I thought Hillary Clinton was a bitch. And when you actually saw it on video, you have Connie Chung leaning over saying, this is just between you and me. So here you have this 70-something-year-old woman who's being befriended by this nice person, mm-hmm. and who is being promised this is just between you and me. And when I heard it that morning, first of all, I was embarrassed for my mother, because here she is, her son's about to become Speaker of the House, and this comes out, okay? Second, my father, who had been in Vietnam and hated the news media, had bent over backwards, had actually baked an upside-down cake for Connie Chung, and was just so personally betrayed. And so I started from there. I mean, you know, do I think there are reporters who will deliberately be sleazy, vicious, personal, and do so in a manner designed to maximize damage? Sure. So I go into every interview, including this one, thinking, you know, I mean, I have no
That's
idea what you guys,
point.
How much research you've done, or what you might raise.
We know everything.
And my job is to be very relaxed, and then to rely on speed rather than preparation. You're intuiting the audience. It's like being a jazz musician. And so you and the audience are in the same zone. And that's what happened to John King, is that the audience decided instantaneously they were with me, and therefore they were against him. I mean, it's almost a zen. You relax totally. You absorb the question. You feel the audience environment. And then you intuit what you should say.
You're also sort of describing the way comedians talk about the room and understanding the room and the dynamics.
One of the books that shaped my high school years was The Funny Man by Steve Allen, which is a great history of comedians.
How did it shape you?
Because of learning different styles of comedy and different ways of thinking about comedy. And exactly your point. I mean, if you're vaudeville, and I've always had the vaudeville rule that this is no matter how small the audience, it's the only show they paid for. and therefore you owe them 100%. Okay. But in vaudeville, you can do a shtick for 25 years. On radio and then television, you ate it up in one night.
I am curious about the debates, that if you've watched the Republican debates, and if you thought if anybody is doing well as you have in the debates, or...
Look, I tell everybody, I could not imagine how I'd run this year. These debates are totally different. Partially, I said to Bill O'Reilly one night, you need to understand that Trump is the grizzly bear in the Revenant.
Oh, you're a tough guy, Jeb.
And we need to have a leader that is
real tough.
You're never going to be president of the United States by insulting your way to the presidency.
Let's see, I'm at 42 and you're at 3, so far I'm doing better.
Doesn't matter.
So far I'm doing better. You know, you started off over here, Jeb. You're moving over further and further. Pretty soon you're going to be off the end.
When you hit him, he devours you. He can't help himself. And so he creates an environment unlike anything I've ever seen. And
so what would you do if you were on stage?
Yeah.
I'd say, beat him up.
But wouldn't, if you're running against Trump, have to at some point attack him? Right. I mean, isn't that the issue? Is that they've waited
too long?
That's
why I'm not running against Trump.
So you come out of South Carolina, you obviously had an incredible win there, and you head into Florida, and I think it's fair to say that you will now go down in history as the first victim of a super PAC in a presidential election. What?
It was kind of cool.
It was kind of cool?
Yeah.
I can't imagine it was cool. Huh. It must have been painful.
How was it cool?
Well, you just said it.
You're a historical anecdote.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I'll always be a little anecdote. Remember, I'm a historian.
I'll always be
this little footnote in these books. Now, I mean, there are two parts to that, by the way. One is that we were just in an overmatch. We were a mid-sized college team in the Super Bowl. And so in that sense, we were in trouble. But the other was, there was this article in the New York Times, I think 2 or 3 days after South Carolina, where they quote a Romney conference call on Sunday morning, where one of his folks says, if you do not eviscerate Gingrich, he's going to be the nominee. Now, I have been a very tough person my whole life, and I don't mind being tough. Eviscerate's really strong. And when I look back, I mean, the fact that they ran a commercial saying I favored the Chinese one-child policy because I'd voted for, I think, the IMF or the World Bank, or they took one article critiquing Reagan and said I was an anti-Reagan Republican by a guy who, by the way, had refused to endorse Reagan in 84. I mean, there's a certain zone there. And I think, actually, I got too tired, and I don't think I handled the two debates in Florida very well.
Was it because you were under that barrage?
It was probably under the barrage and a sense of being bewildered. And also, they set up some people who I thought were personal friends of mine. I mean, at one point, you have Connie Mack Jr., and Mary Bono at the back of one of my crowds saying vicious things about me. And those are both people. I mean, Connie Mack's father is one of my closest friends, and Mary Bono I'd helped after Sonny died. And you just thought, you know, I mean, this is a level of viciousness that is just goofy.
When did you know that Florida was going to turn out as badly as it did?
Oh, we knew within a couple of days of getting down there because you saw 9 anti-Gingrich ads an hour.
Newt has a ton of baggage, like the fact that Gingrich was fined $300,000 for ethics violations.
And there was nothing you could do, right?
Right.
In those debates, it did seem like Romney had started to learn from you. He had gotten way more aggressive and started to take you seriously, and he came prepared. But I mean,
I think that's fair. I couldn't figure out. This was not a new problem. And I'd said to our core team in mid-December that if you're dealing with somebody who has the scale of resources he has and who is as willing to lie as he is, if you don't figure out a way to make him radioactive, he will be the nominee. And we couldn't figure out a way to make him radioactive.
You did dabble a tiny bit in those Bain attacks before dialing it back.
Yeah.
Did you recognize that it was not
going to
work?
It just doesn't work. It was counterintuitive. Plus, the other thing was people were so desperate to beat Obama in our party that they really flinched if you picked on Mitt, because they thought Mitt was probably going to be the nominee. And so they really wanted Mitt to be propped up because, after all, you know, he may be the only hope we have.
So was there competing pressures within your campaign or to your campaign to lay off him in certain ways or to – I mean, what were some of the ideas?
Yeah, you had to modulate. I mean, you just said – because you could feel it in the audiences. I mean, you had to – and you could feel it in the commentary and what have you.
Do you think you ever could have gotten to a position where you could have beat Mitt?
Potentially, yeah. But on the Sanders model of just getting enough grassroots support, we were right at the early stages of being able to do enough internet, enough YouTube, you know, that you could actually do an amazing amount without having a traditional operation.
So fair to say
it's grown enormously in the 6 years since.
Fair to say that you wanted to build a Bernie Sanders campaign in 2012.
And we were fascinated by I was very intrigued by Matt Bai's book, The Argument, and the whole rise of the organizations on the left, Move On, et cetera. I was very intrigued with how Howard Dean built that first wave in 2004 and thought there were a lot of opportunities to start building that kind of thing. And it fits some stuff we had done. We used to have, back when we were doing C-SPAN in the 80s, there were a group in eastern Iowa, I think in Waterloo, there were a group of women who would watch us on C-SPAN and then get together and talk about it. And they were Republican women, you know. And they particularly loved Bob Walker. And one of our great stories was one time Jack Kemp is down in Puerto Rico, and this woman runs up to him. She says, "Aren't you in Congress?" And he says, "Yes, yes, I am." She says, "Do you know Bob Walker?"
Wow.
And Kemp comes back laughing and saying, you know, I'm thinking she's going to be all about me. She said, "No." And she said to him, "We watch Bob Walker every week."
For the record, Jack Kemp was a football star.
That's right.
You know, famous.
And the most famous House Republican of his
generation.
And
Bob Walker was kind of a dorky wonk.
Yeah. My wife, Bob's a very close friend of mine. My wife said he's sort of like a teapot if you watch him on the floor of the House. And he gave lots of floor speeches. So we got a T-shirt that said, "I know Bob Walker." And we gave it to Kemp.
That's awesome.
But my the point I'm making is, you could see the beginnings of an ability to network outside the traditional systems.
Yeah, but I mean, you could see that with what you're talking about with C-SPAN, with how Dean built his campaign largely from outside of the media as an insurgent, and right. Then the way. How do you think Sanders is improving on all those models? Because he seems to have.
Well, the Democrats are still at least a half generation ahead of us in the internal understanding of all this stuff. And they represent the segments of society that are the largest users of the internet. So there's a much larger bias in favor of them being able to do that. And then he represents the true faith. And that's always, I mean, the advantage you always have on the right and left is if you're of the true faith, you build a level of energy. Now, historically, what's happened is the establishment could overmuscle you. But when Sanders said the other night, which I loved, on the New Hampshire primary in his victory speech, he said, you know, Hillary's running off to Wall Street to raise some more money. I would like to do a fundraiser right now. Will all of you go and give $27 at, you know, BernieSanders.com? Thank you. That was our fundraiser. Now let me go back to, you know, raise $3 million in 24 hours. Had we been able to do that,
then we
would have kept Romney on balance.
Yeah, and his speech wasn't really a victory speech. It was a campaign fundraising speech, and he knew it. He saw that moment.
Yeah, I would incredible. Say that they were substantially more developed than I was in how to do this. Part of what we tried to do, which may strike you as a little bit strange, is, and then because I remember now, I campaigned starting in 1974.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I worked for 16 years to create a majority. Then I was speaker for 4 years. I mean, and then we created American Solutions, and, you know, so we've been doing this stuff for a long time. And I once called Gaylord and was whining, and I said, you know, I feel like I'm spending my life. And he said, "No, this is your life. If you don't want this to be your life, you better pick something else to do. But you're not spending your life. This is your life."
All right, quick break here. Newt is referring to Joe Gaylord, his longtime advisor who didn't end up joining the 2012 campaign because of health reasons. All right, back to the show.
And I think part of what we tried to do is on a regular basis find something that amused me. Because we went to the San Diego Zoo recently, for example.
Good zoo.
Yeah, it's a great zoo. And last Valentine's Day, my wife actually gave me a night at the museum in New York. And I went to the American Museum with her.
Well, that's
pretty
awesome.
Spent the night, yeah. But so, you know, if you go to the St. Louis Zoo, which is a great zoo, and was Marlon Perkins' zoo, after he was in Chicago and did Zoo Parade, and then he went down there and did Wild Kingdom. Two or three or four hours of forgetting everything else and hanging out with animals and talking to people who understand them and all that rejuvenates me for a week.
Did you have to let off steam in Florida when like it was going poorly or pressure?
No, because I had known from mid December on that we were fighting a game against somebody who was both enthusiastically dishonest and had enormous resources. And literally, I spent time talking to Gaylord and others and trying to figure out if you couldn't make him radioactive, he was going to win. And so.
I'm curious as to, like, after when
that's,
you
that's
won.
It's a little bit like playing out a poker hand where you figure out you're not going to win it, you know.
When did you realize? I mean, you won South Carolina, so you must have been somewhat optimistic or.
I thought we had a real shot, and it was the combination of the news story describing the level of ruthlessness they were ready to engage in and the scale of resources. When we got to Florida and realized they had been on TV for 3 weeks attacking me.
So what's the biggest lesson you take from your race for president?
It's extraordinary to be an American. It's extraordinary to be able to do this.
You don't strike me as someone who, you know, there's certain people who really feel like they have to be president, and if they fall short of that goal, they probably are upset. Are you one of those people?
I have to be a citizen. And I offered a particular version of citizenship, and the country said no. This country's prerogative. You know, but it helps. I mean, it helps to have been the first Republican speaker in 40 years.
The House of Representatives, our new speaker, the gentleman from Georgia, Newt Gingrich.
You know, it helps to have done the contract and to have done welfare reform and balanced the budget. It allows me to be sort of, you know, I'm still today the longest serving teacher in the senior military. I talk to teach 1 and 2 star generals. So I have lots of stuff. As Christina can tell, we stay busy every day.
You're the first victim of a super PAC, too.
That's right. See, and another asterisk. So someday when we list all the different things Newt Gingrich should be, you know, smashed by super PAC for first time.
Mr. Speaker,
right.
Thank you very much.
Great fun. I hope this was useful.
That was former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich on his beautiful, tragic, Shakespearean 2012 run for the White House. Thank you very much to the Speaker and his staff, who were very accommodating in our interview when we did it out in his office in Arlington, Virginia. A huge thanks, as always, to our fearless editor, Christine Canetta, who makes this look good, I hope. As always, you can find Candidate Confessional at iTunes and on thehuffingtonpost.com. Please subscribe to our podcast, go there, review, and rate it, and then, you know, when you're done with that, tell your friends to do the same. Next week, you're not going to want to miss this guest, a man named Andre Domeys. Now, who is that, you ask? Andre Domeys holds the distinction of having lost to Rob Ford, the crack-smoking mayor of Toronto. We ask him how he was able to actually lose that race. Till next time, dear listener, happy trails.